Welcome to TLDR AusPol, the podcast for the engaged-ish people of the world.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of TLDR AusPol.
Good start.
I literally just said to Annabelle, wow, our last few recordings I haven't had to edit.
Will you edit this bit out or will we just keep going?
No, we're pushing on. I haven't got time to edit this thing.
Please go to AusPol, everyone, not AusPol.
AusPol. I don't know what you'll find if you go to TLDR AusPol.
I don't even want to make any jokes on that.
No. Let's find out, though. Well, maybe not. TLDR AusPol is what you're listening to, just in case you missed the memo. It is episode 4. I am chuffed to be back in the studio with you, Annabelle.
Hello.
Once again, Annabelle is up in Sydney town having a bit of a sleepover at my house.
I am.
We went on a bit of a sushi train date last night. We were
so
talking
good. All
things policy in our next few episodes, and it's just really exciting to be digging into our first policy today.
Woo-hoo.
Woohoo! We're tackling a policy today that is very close to our collective hearts here at TLDR AusPol. And it's one that we've, as most things, had some really great conversations on. But it's actually also a policy that thus far our whole government, all of government, all sides of government have agreed is a policy that really needs to happen.
Yeah.
And so the thing that I'm looking forward to about today's episode is that I think it's a really nice entry into discussing policy.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about something that's really important that everyone agrees on, that there is almost no opposition to. But really unpacking the mechanics of something that hasn't actually happened before here in Australia, as far as we could find out.
Yep.
Annabelle, what policy are we chatting today?
This is the call for the Royal Commission into Veteran Suicide and the National Commissioner legislation that was passed by the government a couple of years ago or a year or so ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a biggie. And the really fun thing... There's a couple of fun things about this policy. One of the really fun things is that you've been super involved
in the
campaigning for this thing.
Yeah. So a little anecdote about myself is my beautiful husband, Josh, was an RAAF officer.
Mm.
And he died from brain cancer about in 2017, so just over 3 years ago. And since then, I've been very, very active in my RSL, very, very active campaigning with DVA or campaigning against DVA, really, because we've not really had a lot of support. And the more...
I've raised my hand.
Oh, yeah.
What's DVA?
Oh, I thought you were going to do a button, but you raised your hand. That's a bit different.
Are you okay, hun?
Thank you.
Sorry.
So the DVA is the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Cool.
RSL is the Returned Servicemen's League.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll go a little bit more in depth into the actual kind of... the landscape of veteranhood in a little bit more detail later, but so for me it's been quite a huge passion point of mine because we've come up against a lot, and so part of everything that we've been working on has sort of resulted in this call for a Royal Commission to Veteran Suicide.
Mm.
And so that's kind of what we're going to discuss today, is the process behind all of that. Today is a pretty incredible day to be recording this because the Prime Minister has just announced it.
Yeah.
They've just backed the Royal Commission. So it's been, you know, a bit of a bottle of wine, a bit of a bottle of what, non-alcoholic champagne.
I want a health kick, but I wanted to celebrate, so I bought us a bottle of non-alcoholic champagne.
Presented it to me. I was like, oh, thank you. Like, that's really kind. And then I looked at the label and I was like, oh, thanks so much.
Yeah. And I was like, more experiments happening tonight other than recording more podcast episodes.
Right.
We're going to try some non-alcoholic champagne.
That's right.
But it's totally worth celebrating, and it has been, it's the result of a lot of really heartfelt campaigning.
Yeah.
And, you know, I know from watching you and what you've done, it's just been incredible to see the stories that have come out from the community, to see the way that you guys have gone about it as well. I've learned a lot about what it means to campaign and what it means to lobby and advocate for a particular cause.
Same.
And today's episode, we're really looking at what was the process? What was that process that has just happened that has resulted in that incredibly exciting announcement today of the Royal Commission?
Yeah.
And also, what are some of the nuances of that process?
You
know, so Yeah, we've had some pretty interesting conversations about it thus far, and so I'm really looking forward to exploring a little bit further what happened on this particular issue.
Mm-hmm.
There is a couple of disclaimers with this issue. So we have already mentioned suicide, and it has been the focus of this particular campaign. We know that suicide is an incredibly sensitive issue, and there are a lot of things around suicide and that can be really triggering for individuals. So aside from us doing our best to be super respectful today and in this conversation, Annabelle, where are some of the places that individuals can go for support if anything in this conversation triggers anything particularly harmful for them?
Absolutely. So the Defence All Hours Support Line is a confidential telephone and online service for ADF members and their families. So that's 1-800-628-036. There's Open Arms, which provides 24 hours free confidential counselling and support for current and former ADF members and their families. So that's 1-800-011-046. And then Lifeline is a national charity providing all Australians experiencing a personal crisis with access to 24-hour crisis support and suicide prevention services. So that's 131114. And we'll put them in our episode notes as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, this has been a really interesting topic for me to learn about because obviously, knowing Annabelle and also knowing Josh, your wonderful late husband, these statistics and some of the stuff that I read on the background of this policy was a lot more real to me than it had been in the past. And I mean, we've been laughing a little bit as we've been having our conversations about this policy. Also some conversations about other policies in saying that sometimes I come across as the one in the duo that looks like they have no feelings on things because I'm always like, but why?
No, I get very passionate and very emotional very quickly. And I'm trying really hard to respect the podcast. Keep that out of it and look at these things analytically. But it's, I mean, something like this was always going to be triggering for me. But, you know, it's also extremely important that we talk about it. So I'll try not to like, you know, I try and keep that, I'm trying to, you know, like I wrote in my show notes, in all fairness to ScoMo.
I can't wait for that sentence.
I can't believe that I'm starting our first policy with, in all, please everyone remember this moment.
Yes.
I'm trying really hard to kind of find a middle ground where it's not just like, they're dickheads.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And the interesting thing as well is just how much, let's dive straight into it because I keep saying like we've learned so much. Let's just tell you what we've learned thus far. Veteran suicide and support for Australian veterans is something that has increased in its urgency in the last couple of years. It's one of the biggest things that I learned in this process, right? Yeah. And one of the things that really stood out to me was a recent article in The Conversation that was talking about that increase in urgency for this.
Yeah.
More Australian veterans have actually lost their lives by suicide than have been killed on active duty since we first had personnel deployed to Afghanistan in 2001.
Yeah.
Like them coming home is more harmful to them than us sending them to fight for us, you know, and it's a mind-blowing statistic to think that it's more dangerous for them to come back to their friends, their family, come back to the country that they bravely fought for, and to think that has increased in its frequency and its, you know, ferocity as an issue is really devastating and just that the people that have fought for our country should never have to never have to face.
Absolutely. And their families as well.
And their families and friends. And it really is something that affects so many in the community.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure we all know someone who served,
mm-hmm.
you know, like
mm-hmm.
you and I and Josh
yep.
had dinner many a time,
yep.
you know, so this issue also isn't removed from me. It's a really big thing. And so a couple of years ago there was a little bit of a groundswell started with a lady named Julianne Finney who at the end of 2019 sat down with ScoMo. Are we allowed to call him ScoMo?
I'm gonna call him ScoMo.
Yeah, great. I just wasn't sure whether we were doing the formal thing being the Honourable Prime Minister Scott Morrison.
We're talking about Scott Morrison for those of you who don't know. but we call him ScoMo.
He also calls himself ScoMo, we're so also, I think it's fine.
It's our podcast and we're allowed to do whatever we want.
Whatever we want, exactly. And it's great because I hate being told what to do. So Julianne, Julianne really sadly lost her son, who was a veteran who had gone and fought for our country and served our country to suicide.
Yes.
And so she sat down with ScoMo and was really highlighting this issue and saying, this is a big thing. We really need more movement on this. Mm-hmm. The services that we have currently don't support our veterans. Help me. Mm-hmm. Help me help the community. And at that point in time, it was really interesting. That was really when, from what I understand, and please correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, from what I understand, that was when we really started seeing the language of Royal Commission is the solution here, like appear on the public landscape of it. And so really from that time, there was this, like, a lot of pressure being put on the government from the veteran community.
Yeah.
To say we need a Royal Commission into this so that our veterans get the services that they need.
And Jackie Lambie was another huge advocate for that too. That language started coming from her as well.
Yeah. So yeah, end of 2019, Julianne Finney sits down with Scott Morrison and he, promises to look into a Royal Commission, I believe. Was what happened. It also, you know, could be potentially...
I'm looking at Reed not knowing whether or not... I mean, I know Julianne and, you know, so I'm not sure, again,
I also think the podcast. Publicly at the end of 2019, this may be irrelevant to the learning of the podcast, but anyway, I'm gonna finish the sentence that I started. I believe that at the end of 2019, a Royal Commission was promised.
Yes. Yes.
And anyway, we fast forward a little bit further, right? Only a couple of months down the track, early 2020, so last year, before the dreaded C word hit. And what was actually announced was a national commissioner. So the appointment of a national commissioner instead of announcing a royal commission.
Correct.
Now, what we're about to launch into is a little bit of a chat, or just a bit later, actually, a bit of a chat into the difference between a royal commission and a national commissioner.
Yeah.
Because for us in our exploration of this topic, that was a really interesting distinction and a really important distinction to explore.
Yeah.
But the royal commission wasn't actually announced. And so following 12 months of not really seeing a whole lot from the national commissioner, a couple of months ago, maybe 2 months ago now, the groundswell with Labor for Veterans and Families started again with yourself and a big part of the veteran community down in Victoria. Really picking it back up and saying we still haven't gotten the Royal Commission.
Yeah, and definitely Julianne Finney is continuously, and Jackie Lambie as well, continuously banging that drum too. So you know, that was... Yeah, it was definitely sort of resurfaced, or we saw a new push.
Yeah, for it, come back again. But one of the questions that I had from this podcast, from the process of this podcast, Annabelle, was, so really what we're talking about is an inquiry into, maybe I shouldn't use the word inquiry because that's a different parliamentary process altogether, but an exploration as to where aren't our veterans getting the support they need?
Yeah.
You know, like what's wrong with the current system that we're losing more of our personnel to our veterans to suicide than we are to active duty?
Yeah.
And so the Royal Commission would independently explore all the chinks in the chain and make sure that at the end of it, we had a series of recommendations that made sure that our veterans got the support that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
And so my first question then was like, well, what is the current state of affairs? Like, what are the services that we provide to veterans currently?
Yeah.
You know, and who does what and where and why aren't they getting the support they need?
It's interesting too, because I know so much about this space, yet I don't know everything, and it's a hard question to answer. So there's a few things. So there's DVA, Department of Veterans Affairs, that you buttoned me for before.
I just wanted you to explain it, because there's heaps of people like me who would just smile and nod and be like, oh yes,
is that what's been happening?
Oh, like, yeah, I do that all the time to you.
Not just you, but everyone. Okay. I get it. So DVA, Department of Veterans Affairs, is the government body that is responsible for providing welfare to financial welfare and support to return servicemen, and one of the thing, and so I'll go through a little bit more in more detail in a sec, but then you've got the RSL, which is a return services league, which is an ESO, which is an ex-service organisation. Mm-hmm. So an ex-service organisation such as RSL will provide support and welfare to veterans in, you know, and we all know what an RSL is. It's it's sort of a club that has sort of, I'm going to use the word devolved over time, and maybe you'll button me for that, but essentially they were set up to be clubs for veterans or spaces for veterans and returned servicemen and families to meet and be together. And then there's also repatriation that can take place for more kind of high needs. Kind of, so we've got in Melbourne, we've got Ward 17, which is run through the Austin Repat, which is essentially hospital beds for, you know, repatriation of sort of higher sort.
And so with...
Ray's got her hand up.
Yeah, I've got my hand
again,
up.
Again, flouting the button rules.
So I really am tonight, aren't I? I'm like, no
I
button.
I bloody love the button, and I pushed it way up. Too much in the first three episodes.
You really did. We have to keep it up. With the difference between, like, the RSL and the... What was the other one you used? The ESOs?
Oh, yeah, ESOs.
Do the RSLs and the ESOs have access to government funding to provide the services they do?
Yes.
Okay.
So, yes.
And some, are they state-based? So do they apply to, you know, a state government body or a federal government body?
The RSL is a federated model. And so, again, I don't really completely understand what that means, because every federated model has its own nuances.
Mm-hmm.
So basically the RSL is a national – there's a national RSL branch, and then there are state RSL branches. So there's one in Victoria, for example, RSL Victoria, and then there are sub branches. Okay. So there are I'm on the committee of my sub branch, which is Hawthorne, and, you know, there are sub branches that are sort of pokies driven and some that aren't, which is a whole separate issue, the pokies issue, you know, which is one of the, you know, the reasons for, we believe, for some of these issues that we're seeing. You know, and we're also seeing basically, so the four kind of areas that I talked about, so DVA, you know, it's we now have four DVA acts, and I tried to go through and sort of give a little summary on each of the acts, but I've showed Ree my notes before, and there's like something, it's like, Vietnam veterans had this act, and then I like scribbled it out. No, it's not CIRCA, it's MIRCA. No, actually it's not MIRCA, it's DIRCA. So there's four acts.
And the acts are designed, correct me if I'm wrong, to like classify the different types of veterans and kind of make sure that the needs of that particular category are met, because they may be different according to their age, where they served.
So we started with the VEA, which is the Veterans Entitlements Act,
mm-hmm.
Which was pretty sort of all-encompassing.
Yeah.
This was back in the day.
Back in the day.
The days of yore.
Not yesterday.
And slowly, you know, we've added all of these different acts, which have more and more kind of, to the point where I don't even know what act Josh fell into. And now we're finding that with all of these acts and with this clunky process, DVA has a lead time of like 18 months, you know, from coming home, putting in a DVA application, which oftentimes you need an advocate for, you know, whether it's volunteer or paid, but we have DVA advocates.
And you have to go through this process to access any sort of support from any level of those organizations.
I believe so.
Yeah.
In terms of DVA. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So then you've got, so that's happened with DVA.
Yeah.
Then you've got, RSLs, which, like I sort of mentioned before, they've sort of turned into more general public clubs, you know, and pokies, venues and all that kind of thing. So in terms of, you know, veterans and families rocking up and feeling safe. I mean, I feel safe to bring Prim to my local RSL, but there are some that I don't feel safe to bring my daughter to.
Yeah.
So that's kind of happened. Then you've got the ex-service organisations as a whole, that the ESO space was built on two ESOs. So RSL, which I've talked about, and Legacy, which was for families.
Yeah.
And Legacy, you know, they pay for Prim's daycare.
Yeah,
you know,
amazing.
Legacy are incredible.
Yeah.
But now we've got hundreds and hundreds of ESOs who are trying to fill these gaps in, you know.
Yeah. Which also isn't unusual for like the third sector or the charitable space, which is where the ESOs fall into, right? Mm. Because what happens with welfare services from a government perspective is like the federal government sets the particular strategy and works out like what do we have to allocate to what particular causes.
Mm.
They then push that down to the state governments to say, you know, right, you've got this pot of money to use on this particular issue. You know, you decide how you're going to do that. And then, but there gets to a point where the government doesn't have the capability or the capacity to offer services that they run, right? Mm. And so they say the third sector have a better placed to offer services. So we'll make sure that the third sector have the support they need to do what they need to do well. But what ends up happening is the charity space gets very cluttered. Mm. And what this means for our veterans is that there is a bunch of different ESOs that are doing similar things, the same things, with reduced capacity and resources.
Some have no members in them, though.
No members, because it's so cluttered. So from what I'm hearing, is just it's a really cluttered space for our veterans to get support, which, you know, like if I've just gotten home from a tour of duty and I'm aware of the fact that I need support, to then think that I've got a minimum of an 18-month waiting period before I get the piece of paper that says I can then go actually access the services that I need. Like, it's the reality of that is really scary.
It starts to paint a picture, doesn't it? Obviously I've got so much more to say, but in the interest of time, let's like move forward. So basically what I was hoping to get from you, because I know that you've gone and done a lot of research on what's a Royal Commission and what's a National Commissioner. Mm-hmm. I'd love to get your perspective on that, and maybe then I can comment on a little bit on the nuance of this particular space.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. So basically the process that I went through for this, you know, for this podcast was to go, right, I need to understand a bit about the space, which you did for me just then and said, right, we've got a really cluttered system and it's really there are a lot of chinks in that chain. So obviously what's happened, right, is the community have gone, right, the way that we've seen government approach this in the past is through a Royal Commission, when there has been systems that have been identified to not be operating optimally for the outcome that they need. A Royal Commission has gotten, you know, what they need, which is kind of where that initial, you know, groundswell comes from, in saying, like, we've got a system that needs inspection, you know, and so, right, how do we know to go about that with a Royal Commission? But then when the government didn't announce a Royal Commission but announced a National Commissioner, at first I was so unaware that there would be a difference in that. You know, like, I was like, oh, has the word commission in it, must be pretty much the same thing. But no, I was mistaken. So here's my TLDR on the difference between a Royal Commission and a National Commissioner.
Great.
A Royal Commission typically fits two different categories. The first is primarily investigative, with the aim of uncovering the truth about something. And the second is more along the lines of research, to provide info to government that will inform policymaking. The recent Royal Commissions that we've seen, and I think these recent examples were one of the things that kind of skewed my view on whether or not I thought a Royal Commission was the right or, you know, a right way of approaching this particular issue, keeping in mind that I think every way we approach this issue is the right way to approach this issue. But recently, and what our listeners have probably heard as well, is things like the Royal Commission into aged care, the Royal Commission into youth detention, finance and banking practices, institutional child sexual abuse. Like, and the interesting thing about a Royal Commission is that there's usually, like, there's usually a bad guy that you're wary of, that you're trying to, and so that first purpose of investigative over research is what we see more of in Australia. The other nuance to a Royal Commission is that there is, what happens is the first part of the process is like defining the scope and defining the problem that you're trying to solve with the Royal Commission. And so there are quite set boundaries. So the first part of it is consulting with the community and then saying, here are the terms of reference of this Royal Commission. And you really can't venture outside of that scope once it's set. And basically what happens is throughout that process, anyone can be called upon to come and give testimony and give evidence to what they've experienced, what they've seen, what they've done. And at the end of it, a list of recommendations is given to government to say, this is what we think is best for this particular issue. So it's time constrained, it's scope constrained, but anyone and everyone can be called up to contribute.
Yes.
Now, that's not what we had. We had a National Commissioner announced. What's written on the National Commissioner for Veteran Suicide's website is that the National Commissioner will work to identify and understand the factors and systemic issues that may contribute to suicide risk among serving and former ADF members and make recommendations to government about actions and strategies. The National Commissioner will have appropriate statutory independence from government.
Yep.
And they'll be able to gather information and evidence, including community consultation, rah rah. The language is quite different, but what struck me was the outcome could be quite similar of having a national commissioner as opposed to going down the path of a royal commission. Mm. So one of the things that I couldn't make sense of was like, oh, why are we still unhappy? You know, like if our national commissioner could in theory and on paper get the same outcomes, you know, and further research has found for me that the national commissioner really has all the same power that a royal commission has, but they don't have that constraint of scope, you know, so they don't have to define and scope their particular issue and only stick to that. It's not time based. That person is appointed for as long as they, you know, as long as the government is paying them to do a particular job. But that in and of itself, right, is one of the things that we were talking about as one of the unspoken power imbalances of the difference between a royal commission and a national commissioner, because a royal commission is the highest level of independent inquiry that you can get in this country.
Yeah.
And they report to the Attorney General, who reports back to Parliament for a royal commission, but the national commissioner reports to government.
Correct.
So it was really interesting because I was looking at this on paper going, we could get the same outcome from a national commissioner as opposed to a royal commission. But there is this kind of power imbalance, whether spoken or unspoken, that could influence the way that things occur. And so I guess my question back to you at the time before, you know, it had been announced today was, well, why are we still upset about there not being a royal commission into it when the option that's been provided could in theory have the same outcome?
So I'm going to start this by, here it is, in fairness to ScoMo. Can you believe it?
I'm giving her a
She's doing a mime clap. So I better quickly quantify what I'm going to say. Look, I have a hunch that ScoMo's first step would have been to reach out to the aforementioned ESOs that I talked about. And I believe he was probably given the advice to go with a national commissioner. You've talked about a little bit about there's some nuanced differences. One of the things is, and I sort of mentioned to you before, like there is already an ongoing commissioner in the REPAC commissioner, which holds DVA accountable.
Mm.
So holding another ongoing commissioner, look, I...
Oh, that was such a noise.
I donged the thing. Obviously, a royal commission is, for me, the best practice. Everyone else gets one. Veterans deserve one. So I've found a few little nuances, and they could be relating to the particular legislation of the National Commissioner. You obviously have done a lot more reading on the general what is a National Commissioner. And you've mentioned some of them in terms of who they report to and things like that. I think as well, you know, the fact that a National Commissioner can't look into criminal matters, whereas a Royal Commission could. And I talked about Ward 17 before, and I'll use that as an example. So there's been a slow dismantling of legislation of Ward 17. There's been less and less beds put aside for veterans. A Royal Commission could look into that and, you know, why are beds being dropped? They could subpoena papers, get the CEO on the stand and, you know, really kind of figure that out.
Mm.
I think you're right with it. You know, there's an identified terms of reference. There is an issue here to be solved. So, I mean, and ScoMo's announcement today, which was basically we're getting both. So, you know, the National Commissioner can't look backwards. The National Commissioner looks forwards, whereas the Royal Commission can look backwards. So we're getting everything. You know, it's a really good outcome, honestly, for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, one of the questions that we asked each other through this process was like, okay, where have we landed, you know, with this policy? We've done some research, me more so than you, because you already know so much about about this particular issue. I've done
just like living it.
Yeah, research. That's big research. You know, we've both done some research into this thing. So where have we landed on like, what do we think? Was this a fair course of action? And I think
mine's so obvious.
Yeah. She's just like, get the alcoholic champagne out.
Non-alcoholic champagne in my glass.
In this glass. I think where I landed with it was that I'm obviously glad we got both. You know, like this issue is big, and it involves anything that involves the lives of Australians is a big matter for government, right? But particularly the men and women that have served our country, you know, losing their own lives more so than taking their own lives more so than losing their life on a tour of duty is a horrendous statistic. So I'm really glad that we're getting both. I think, though, in theory, we didn't need both, you know, and this is where we differ, right, on our opinion. On paper, I think we could have gotten good outcomes with the National Commissioner based on what they are able to do, but didn't do in the time frame. You know, so we had like 12 months of having a National Commissioner and we didn't see outcomes. And so the community were like, well, we're getting back on the horse here. But I think in looking at how slight the nuance is between the two of them, really glad we're getting both. I think it's an incredible opportunity to look backwards and forwards on an issue that's really big for the community. But, you know, I think there's an alternative reality or an alternative future that could have seen us appoint a National Commissioner that got good outcomes as well. So, yeah, I don't know. Where have you landed, Annabelle?
I think, you know, look, you guys know, and as I said before, and I do jest, like, you know, about the non-alcoholic champagne, but for me this has been something that's been so unbelievably powerful and very, very difficult to advocate for. You know, I am well in this community. My personal experience is, you know, my husband died of brain cancer. However, you know, I know I can name a lot of people who have lost someone from suicide or have lost their lives from suicide. So for me, it's been just such a powerful experience to advocate on behalf of these incredible men and women who deserve everything.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, even though I jest about like having a celebratory non-alcoholic bubbles, you know, I do want to just stress the absolute unbelievable reverence of this moment as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So in all, a great day.
A great day
for AusPol.
A great day for AusPol. I can't believe that we were always going to record this, and this is what's happened.
We had this date in the diary for ages, and then today was the day. So exciting.
It's amazing.
It's so exciting. So a big hats off to you. Annabelle, where can people find us if they want to keep in touch on the next episode?
TLDR_AusPol.
Yes.
On the Instas.
On the Instagram.
And wherever you find your podcasts.
Yes, that's where we are.
We are there.
Yes. Thanks so much for joining us for episode 4. It's been a delight, Annabelle. Thank you. Look forward to hearing from you in a fortnight's time.
Likewise.
See ya.
Bye.